You are listening to Golden State of Mindcast. Ivan is here with Nate and Bram. Today, we're happy to be joined by a special guest. You know him as a columnist for the Bay Area News Group. He's been reporting on the Warriors for a decade, probably over a decade now. And you probably also know him as the author of that book that's on your coffee table right now, Golden, The Miraculous Rise of Steph Curry.
Better be on your coffee table.
If it's not on your coffee table yet, then just go buy it. Marcus Thompson II. Marcus, thanks for talking to us tonight.
And thank you. I appreciate it. I appreciate all that you mean to Warriors fans and inadvertently or advertently to my career. I don't know if y'all tried to talk me out, but y'all definitely did.
Wow. Well, thank you. We'll take that credit. That's not a problem. Again, if you haven't picked the book up, the title is Golden, The Miraculous Rise of Steph Curry. You can buy it wherever you can buy books. Totally a must have for Warriors fans. I think the definitive book on Steph Curry, certainly to this point, and probably will be, forever. Pick that up. And, Bram wanted to start out with a few questions. He had this idea about the three Currys that you write about. Bram, you want to take that away?
Yeah, sure. I thought it was such an interesting thing that you brought up on page 63 that was the Mr. Curry, sort of his business persona and the mogul of his, holdings or assets or whatever, and his brand versus Steph, the killer on the floor, versus sort of Stephen, which is the family member. And I just thought, I mean, that's something that we all have thought about and sort of seen as his career has unfolded and as he's become more of a public figure. But with you having sort of, almost unparalleled access to not only to him, but as far as any writer out there, probably to sort of inner circle, I was just kind of curious about how are those three facets of his personality playing out in real time, and how do you sort of see that affecting his life moving forward, and how is he really handling those sort of three like very disparate elements of his personality?
So I didn't think I was trying to kind of like illustrate some of the difficulty in kind of navigating all of this, because the reality is it was really unexpected, and he did have to manage it, and it wasn't easy, and there were bumps. But I just remember, Steph, the dude trying to make a name for himself, and then all of a sudden he becomes this brand mogul, right? And now he has all this access to stuff, and now he's a shot caller. And it's funny, because one of the things he loves about Aisha is that she, quote-unquote, puts him in his place. He likes that somebody is not so enamored by all of the other stuff that they won't tell him what he needs to hear. And so it just all happened so fast, and he got access to so much that he really needed to stay grounded. And juggling those three characters, going from one hat to the next hat to the other, I think he had to learn how to do it. We had so many conversations, just about how we manage it all. Cause Steph's life is a lot, there's so much of it that's like a regular dude, right? some of the right. Stuff that he experiences is a lot like everybody else. I can relate to him. There's been times where we've been on the phone and he walks and he's about to go in the house, and he's all right, I'm about to go in the house. I got to get off the phone. Right. And I say the same stuff. Now you're about to enter into a place where you are not in control. So it's time to get off the phone, right? But it's just funny hearing Steph say that. as soon as you walk through the door, you're about to get your wife coming at you, your kids coming at you, and all kind of stuff. So it's all right, I got to get ready to handle all this. But it's just weird hearing Steph talk like that, like a regular husband who's about to get overwhelmed. And at the same time, he's hanging with Drake and on Jimmy Kimmel. I think there was a time where it was so new that he was yeah, I want all of that, right? If anybody had any opportunity that's dope and fun, you give me that. If it's going on stage and dancing with Lecrae or hanging with Drake, all of that, I want it all. And then I think he had to say, all right, hold on. This is a lot. Now I have to kind of manage this because I do have this other side. So I think that's the part that he might have to explain more just because he will reveal like the difficulties, you know, and the details. But it's definitely something I noticed how he kind of had to juggle that, those different personalities.
And it's funny because you talk a lot about, you know, his upbringing and kind of, you know, being raised by Dell in this basketball community. In a way being raised to understand and know the league and what players go through, but it was never really totally expected of him, right? Like, because he, you know, the kind of early on in his career and through his education, there wasn't really, although he was a stellar player, there wasn't this expectation that he was going to be, you know, a superstar in the NBA. So it's like on the one hand, he saw it and must have had some expectations about what it would be like, but then he's suddenly in it. Like the actual final like jump at the end was so quick that those expectations and the learnings might not have like actually set him up to be prepared for it in a way.
At some point, right? Even Dell had to be like, yes, yeah, Steph, I can't help you with this one, right?
Yeah, right.
Like, this was out my jurisdiction. I don't know what it's like to play in back-to-back Junes and deal with the time away from my family and get my family used to that. Like, that's something they'll probably don't have a plan for. So I think some of the stuff did get bigger than anybody he's probably conversed with about it. And he had to go through it, like, for the first time for everybody, because the only other person he could talk to about this is like LeBron or Kobe.
Or somebody, yeah.
I don't think they was answering his calls though.
And they probably don't have it. Well, I mean, I don't know. I haven't read the definitive book on them, but the idea that like LeBron is going to, you know, pick up the, be on a phone call and say, sorry, like I got to hang up. Like, I just walked in the door and like stuff's about to go down. Like you know what I mean? Like, it seems like he's on this different level of stardom, and has been since he was, you know, 16 basically. And, Steph does seem like like you mentioned Aisha, like the family ties there have totally just like grounded him to a different degree.
You know, that's the part, like, you know, I'm sure we're going to get to it at some point, but that's the part. If I had one thing that disappointed me about LeBron is that in his like rivalry with Steph, he kind of demeaned the good guy about Steph, or kind of played into the narrative that, you know, like Steph ain't hard enough, or Steph, you know, it was just weird. Cause I do think LeBron is also like that. You know, I do think when he gets home, his boys, he's like, all right, I gotta cut stuff off. Right, because I got my boys. And
well, he's publicly
I got my
wife. Like that. I mean, it's not like he's hiding that. It's like a public part of his persona. Yeah,
exactly. So it's a trip. Like I would, you know, as I think LeBron is a good dude, especially from the perspective of how other NBA players are so known to be, like out there in these streets running around getting arrested, and you know the stereotypes. I think he, for so long with the hugest microscope, has maintained himself. I think that will make him embrace Steph. Like, all right, we're going to do rivals, but I see what your brand is about, and it's aligned with what my brand is about, and it's time for us to get some of this for the family guy to be exalted. Like, it's good for everybody, especially good for the black community, that you got two, like, black parents, right? Right. And black dads. Like, so that's the part where I was like, LeBron, like, you are... Like, y'all on the same team in a sense, you know? Like, that's I don't mind him going at Steph at all and saying, look, I know everybody took his crown and put it on Steph, so I don't mind him going with that. I got to take it back from Steph. But at the end of it all, I really wish he would have said, man, I really appreciate what that guy's doing. And maybe that's because we didn't say the same stuff about LeBron, even though it probably exists, maybe because we don't see him as the father and family man and good guy, and instead as the superstar mogul, shot caller, coach, you know, life wrecker, you know, all that stuff. So maybe he was bitter because he didn't get the same kind of love, but I really wish he would have saw that and said, like, I don't want to disrespect the guy because his reputation is being a good guy. like, I don't want to do that because now I'm demeaning good guys and I'm making it about like who's got dirt on them and who's hard and who's that. And here's a guy who's not trying to be that. Like, why give in to the narrative that if you got a family and a wife and you stay out of trouble, like somehow that makes you soft and not good enough. I wish that would have played out a little differently because I think both of them are like that.
Well, yeah, and it seemed like when Steph first came into the league and started, you know, getting some of that attention, that LeBron kind of was on his side a little bit. Like he went to that game at Davidson, and they had an early relationship, and so did Steph and Chris Paul.
From North Carolina.
Yeah, and it's almost like, I think you hit it on the head, Marcus. Like he didn't end up having to go through a lot of the same things that they went through at some point in their career. Like as they were being elevated, like people really tore down LeBron, and they're still tearing down LeBron. And it's like somehow that, like, Steph just skipped that step.
No question at all. And, you know, there is something to that too, right? There is something about, you know, I know when I like started promoting the book, like some people will reply, how miraculous is it really? Like, he's the son of an NBA player, mm-hmm. as if every son of an NBA player ends up here, right? But that's part of it, is that, like, you don't get to this level usually without going through the fire. Like, that's how it works. You know, you got to be tried and tested and examined first. And then you get, you know, exalted. And Steph, like, especially on this scale, like, you know, we've seen Steph since 2009. Most of these fans probably saw him in 2014 for the first time. Mm-hmm. Like, he just dropped out of the sky and was great, and they love him, and their grandmother loves him, and their moms love him. They want the kids to be like him. So, there is something to that. Like, you know, he wasn't in high school, like, making national news because somebody gave him some throwback jerseys worth $800 and he took them. And now the debate is whether that should be illegal or not per NCAA. Like, that's what LeBron had to go through. Steph had to go through that. So it's there. I just don't know why it's not Steph's fault.
Yeah.
I think that that's something too, that you talked about in the book. You had this really beautifully written passage, and it was something that I had kind of actually erased from my memory just as a lifelong Warriors fan. But you were talking about the uncertainty of that surgery that he had that was potentially going to be like a reconstructive ankle surgery, and that he went under the knife not knowing if he'd ever be the same, and sort of like if it would completely cut off his potential or if they were going to have to do a much deeper, you know, procedure than what they ended up doing. And in fact, they only ended up actually cleaning out some debris. But again, you're right in the fact that, like, we lived and died throughout all of that as, you know, Warriors fans, not, or, you know, you covering the team, us as, you know, just following the team and covering it on Golden State of Mind, but, like, you know, not knowing if he'd ever turn into the player that we thought he could become. And then once the ankle issues sort of fell away and luckily stopped being such a constant problem, and then suddenly it just exploded, you know. So I think that that's an interesting the title of the book, like you said, it's that you've gotten a little bit of blowback, but the miraculous rise of Steph Curry, it's like, I mean, he really did rise from the almost like the ashes of his own career, because it almost was career ending, and at a certain point his ankle injuries were career defining. And I was reading that whole section and I was just remembering, like, each incident as it happened. I was like, oh man, this is tough, you know? And I, you know, there's a lot of that as Warriors fans that you kind of push out of your head. And then it's either like OG Warriors fans who have sort of like decided not to ever think about that ever again, or like bandwagon fans, you said, like your grandmother, where he fell out of the sky and he's just this like perfectly formed golden boy who just like took the league by storm. And all of those disparate elements of his personality are definitely like hard to sort of reconcile with one another. And that's why this book is so interesting. So there's not really a question in there.
You remember the days though, right? Like, remember when he would sprain his ankle and everybody's like, oh, here we go again. And he's trying to like fight through it and limp in. And just that feeling of like, this dude, like we see the talent, but he's going to be that story. Like, I remember that. That was the narrative on him. Like, man, Steph's great, but, man, he's got fragile ankles.
I mean, like, I remember watching, like, every time he came back from one of those little injuries, like, even, like, a two-day ankle injury, like, I would just hold my breath the entire game, like, that he came back. It's like, oh, it's going to happen again. Like, I know it's going to happen again. And then, sure enough.
Then it would always happen again. Yeah, that was the thing. It was like, oh, and then it happened again. It's like,
I remember going back through, like, old articles and just trying to count them and getting up to, like, I found, like, 24 instances of a sprained wow. ankle.
Wow.
That's insane, right? I mean, yeah. When you really think about it, it's crazy. It is so crazy that I'm like, what really happened? Because all of a sudden it just stops. Right? It's like, what's the secret here? What kind of man stuff?
Well, it kind of coincided with the Under Armour signing a little bit, right? I mean, maybe they just gave him a better shoe. Is it that simple?
Golden State of Mind is sponsored by Under Armour.
Why did he have to do 24? Why they couldn't figure it out after 15 sprains?
Right.
That's the part. That he had two surgeries. The first one didn't work. And then, remember, he went to Nike. He went to Nike for them to work on his shoe. It still was happening. And he didn't try all kind of braces, trainers, like, and then all of a sudden, like, they were gone. I was like, so what was, like, a regular part? It was like a chronic... It was like a chronic illness he had that he was just going to have to live with. And then all of a sudden it was going. Actually, you know what it coincided with, right? You know when it stopped. When he went to Mark Jackson.
Mark Jackson.
Yes. No, I was actually. Yeah.
Go ahead, Brad.
No, I have these notes. Yeah, I have these notes written down, actually. Didn't he get hurt a couple times after that?
No, he did. He did.
So that was actually one of the craziest stories in your book, and you're talking about him hopping on his injured ankle in front of the congregation, and quote, he said to you that he didn't know what else to do, as if he had almost been like coerced into it by Mark and his wife. Like, how was that conversation with Steph when he was telling you that story about going to Mark's church
and
having them pray over his ankle and like, yeah.
I think it was just one of those experiences he had never had before.
Not a lot of people have, but yeah.
Exactly, right? I mean, I've been going to church all my life. I ain't never had that happen. But
you never had Mark Jackson pray over one of your body parts and hope that it gets better?
I never had anybody pray over one of my body parts. And if they did, I'd be wondering about their sanity. But that's just me, right? I don't even think Steph thought it was like a bad thing or a crazy thing, and I don't think it is either. I mean, it's they're people too; they have their beliefs. That's fine. I think it was just such a new experience for him because his congregation was really like the opposite of that. It was very conservative, affluent. You know, I went there once when I was doing some research for an article, and it's it's like how 90% of churches are, where you come in on Sunday, everybody dressed nice, you sit there, say a couple amens, you be kind, and then you leave. So I think the whole experience was just new to him. So when he said he didn't know what to do, I think he really did not know, like, what did she mean? What did she expect me to do? And I think he took it as, like, he thought in his mind, you know, it was very well-intentioned. They were doing the best thing they thought they could do for me, and I think he appreciated that, which is why he participated. But it was an experience that was way far from, you know, the church where he met Aisha. Right. I mean, one is like a predominantly black church ran by a very charismatic preacher and his wife, and the other is, you know, a very affluent, predominantly white church in Charlotte where, you know, service started at 10:30 and it started at 10:30 and it ended at 11:30, right?
Do you know if Steph has gone back to Mark Jackson's church? Like, does he do that regularly?
I really don't think so. I think they went again, like, as a team after that. You know, I think when they were coaching, I know they went, more than once. I know that because we would be in LA and all of, He would invite players, media, and all that, and you know, they several would go, some wouldn't. So I know it was more than one occasion. I know that. So I'm not sure if that was the last one or the first one. I'm pretty sure it was the first one because I remember him telling me about it. Like, it was such a new experience for him. And I remember talking about it. So I think they went back again after that, just as a team. I know David Lee went. Matter of fact, they did go back because I think there was one of the players, like, you know how on where they have the I don't know what to say, and I don't really want to like defame what they do, but he really had an experience there. Mm-hmm. I forgot who it was. It was like an end of the bench guy, and they were like, "Wow, wow. You know, he like, you know, he had an experience there." It was another player had experience, so they definitely went back after that.
Huh.
Yeah. So you know, you in chapter eight. This is Nate speaking. In chapter eight, you went through a lot of the race, religion. Mentioned Dwight Howard and how Dwight Howard kind of tried to come out and be more of the, he wanted to be the evangelical, didn't really work, and Curry kind of watched that. But how does Curry kind of see himself like as a black Christian man, especially when you bring up the piece about the light skin, the colorism piece in there that you mentioned in chapter eight? Like, has he ever addressed that with you directly, or is that something that he's kind of been mum on?
Well, it's been like a running thing, you know, for as long as he and Clay has been a backcourt, right?
Right, yeah, like a light-skinned backcourt, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, he's heard it all his life.
Right.
So, like, he hasn't had the philosophical discussion, but he definitely hears it. He understands it. He and Seth had to deal with it. Like, he knows that in many minds, light-skin equals soft.
Right.
And in that vein, he really tries to avoid anything that makes him look soft. Like, really, which is why the ankle issues was so, like, not just physically debilitating, but emotionally, because right. he looked soft. And, you know, he looked like a wounded bird trying to fight. And he would try to fight through it and hurry back. But he's like a Marty McFly in Back to the Future. Like, don't call him chicken. Like, for Steph, that's calling him soft. So I know from a religious perspective, he doesn't like being that guy. Right. You know what I'm saying? Like, he doesn't like preaching to people. He's one of those people who's like, look, just whatever you want to know about my faith, just look at my life. And if you ask me a question, like, one-on-one, I will answer it. I will tell, you know, I will share whatever my heart tells me to share, but I'm not going to take a podium and try to evangelize the world. His whole thing is, I'm going to do it with my life. If people see me and they see that I'm good or they like how I behave, like, that's his quote unquote ministry. So I know he's real. Like, whenever you ask him about it, like, he will answer, but you can tell he's like, what are you going to say? Like, don't put me out there. Like, you know, like, he's not Mark Jackson. They were aligned in that way, like, in their religion, but they were different in how they presented it. Some of the stuff that Mark Jackson did, Steph would never do it. And he definitely wouldn't do what Dwight Howard did. He just likes to, you know, hey, this is who I am. It's, you know, but I'm not going to try to impose that. And the light skin thing is just like, that's his bent, man.
Yeah.
Like, this is why he won't say anything back, or this is why I know, you know, this has been a topic in Warriors world forever, right?
Yeah.
Am I allowed to say that? I can't put those two words together, huh? My bad.
No, it's all good. No hostility.
We're all friends here.
It's all good.
I'll do that to you. So, like, the whole refs thing, right? And how Steph gets fouled, and when it's time for him, like, when you ask him about it, he won't ever say, like, you know, so much has happened. Instead, he'll say, you know, it's part of the game. I just got to adjust, because the moment he says, man, they're fouling me and the refs aren't doing it, in his mind, he's like, that's him taking the soft route.
Right.
So all that is a bunch of that little stuff that he just won't do because he's been fighting this soft label all his life. And it's because he knows when people look at him, they're going to think he's soft.
So when, like, behind the scenes, though, I was wondering about this because, you know, we're watching this Utah series and we're seeing him just like always. Steph is, and Clay, but Steph especially, just held and grabbed, and you know, jerseys being held every time they're trying to get open. They're doing a lot of those you know, kind of off-ball actions that the refs aren't paying as much attention to, for one. So it does feel, and probably rightly so, that Steph is held more than other players and fouled off the ball more than other players. And yeah, we don't see him complain to refs, but like behind the scenes, like, does he ever talk about that a little bit? Like, man, you know, like that was some BS, or like why aren't they giving me that attention? Or is it just like he's got that persona down at all times, and you can just kind of, he just keeps it bubbling inside.
Like in conversation, like he recognizes it, like, yeah. You know, he'll say, of course, all they're doing is holding, right? That's he'll say, like, here's the game plan, right? I know what they're doing. They're just going to hold me. I remember those early years. Remember when Chris Paul used to like kind of dominate that matchup, like when the Clippers actually be better, and there would be like a moment in the game, especially when it was close, where Chris Paul would just be like, all right, I'm shutting down Steph. And he would just physically overwhelm him, right? But really, he was just fouling. Like, that's all it was. He just come and just, I'm going to foul you 20 times. They might call a two. And Steph would turn the ball over. And I remember asking Steph about the game. So it was like, at some point, like, is anybody going to say something about the fouls? He's like, that's, like, everybody sees what's happening, and he says, I just got to get stronger, that's all. So when he does foul me, I don't, I'm not losing the ball. But he's like, all he's doing is fouling, and all they're doing is holding. So he knows what's happening, but in a real, like, weird kind of way, I think he sees this as his, like, rite of passage. You know, I think Steph is, first off, he's all about big picture, and I think at the end, if you were able to say, man, he used to go through all that and you never heard him complain, he just took it and he, like, you know, wheeled through it. Like, I think he wants that to be said about him. That's why he doesn't sell the call, right? Like, dude, just do James Harden, dude. But, yeah. Like, he doesn't want to do it, you know? So he's like, at the end, when they say, like, in 20 years when we're watching the 30 for 30, we'll say, hey, that dude used to get fouled all the time. Nobody got fouled like him. Look, nobody gets double teamed more than him. Nobody gets blitzed more than him. Like, we don't even talk about that stuff. He gets double teamed every game.
Yeah.
Like Jordan used to, right? Yeah. But so I think he's banking on you and I, like, seeing that, and a smart basketball fan seeing that and giving him credit for powering through it. I think and part of his mind is like, in the end, they will all see if I just stick it out, tough it out, and keep going. Even my peers who I really want to see, they will eventually see.
Well, and that's actually...
Yeah, go ahead, Brent.
There's two things in that kind of perk my interest. Is one of that is like, how much of that do you think is dependent on his faith? That's sort of like the basic tenets of modern Christianity with, you know, Jesus suffering and like... Do you think that like goes into it with him sort of maybe trying to follow that path of being like not trying to draw attention to his own like struggles? Do you think that's part of it?
Hey, so can we bring in, like, I know when y'all do the production on this, can we bring in the church music right now? Like, this is where I want to hit the camera. If you get deep,
I'll try to do that. So imagine that it's happening. Imagine that in behind you right now.
I think that's a lot of it, right? And I don't know if he's like directly, you know, Paul said, you know, suffer as a Christian, and if you suffer anything, so I don't know if he's going there with it. But I think he likes this idea of, I can endure because of my faith. So whatever y'all throw at me, you watch at the end how I'm still standing. Like, that's his kind of mindset. Bring it. Double teams, traps, fouls, whatever. Mock me in social media. Call me. Say whatever you want to say. Bring it. Because in the end, I will endure, and I will endure because of my faith. And then you will say, man, how'd you do all that? And then he'll say, because of Christ, right? That's like the game plan. That's his rope-a-dope method.
But, like, probably not until he's done playing, I would guess, right? Basically.
Yeah, I think he knows it's like the reward is later. Steph even knows this happens all fast. So here's the crazy part. Like, here's the part that sometimes I want to ask these guys. I did ask a couple guys. Like, I didn't get really permission. I'm not one of the reporters who like to blast people, especially on how they feel. Like, for me, if you feel a certain way, I need you to say it. Yeah, otherwise, I can't govern people. So I don't know what you really feel. You could be lying. So some people would say something, and I was trying to get them to come on the record and say what they feel, but they wouldn't. So I remember asking one player, like, do you not understand that on most of this stuff, on much of this stuff, Steph agrees with you. Like, he's on their side. Like, he thinks it all happened really fast. Right? In his mind, he's like, you know what? In 2013, we lost to San Antonio in the playoffs, and he was like an up-and-comer. So, all right, I'm going to come back. In 2014, they lost in the first round to the Clippers, and Chris Paul was, quote-unquote, the best point guard in the NBA. Like, that's how it happened. And in 2015, he's the MVP. So, in his mind, he's like, yeah, it all kind of happened fast. That's what I asked him after game 7. I was like, man, what does that feel like going from on top of the world and then after game 7, like, everybody's ridiculing you? And he was like, oh, I get it. I understand. Like, people were waiting for it because, like, I got here fast. And, you know, it's hard to believe it's something that got here fast. But, you know, I'll be back. Like, on many of the stuff, you ask him about, all right, man, are you as good as Jordan? He, like, chill. Right? You know, that's us. He's like, yeah, I would like to be the greatest player of all time. But he knows. Like, that's Jordan. Like, his dad played against Jordan. So. Right. It's funny just how some of the thoughts that people have, the reasons that make them want to, like, diss Steph, a lot of it, like he kind of agrees with them on it. Like, he understands, like, I know people love me, and I can't tell people not to love me, or I'm not saying they should. But I think in his mind, he would rather it be like, well, you should love this guy, too, for the same thing, right? Because he's just, instead, they're like, don't love Steph because you don't love Russell Westbrook in the same way. You know, that's just, it's just weird how that plays out.
Well, people are interesting, to put it lightly. It's something that we cover on this podcast quite often, but I think that's something, one of the more beautiful sentences that you wrote was, you said, quote, maybe Steph, like, he has a blowback from being wholesome. And there's also the element, like you bring up Westbrook, that Curry in a way is somewhat ostracized from the rest of the NBA because maybe he's living in a different universe, and that, you know, for us as regular NBA fans, like, looking at Steph, there's a lot of ways in which we can relate to him. Like, you're talking about it feels like he came along really fast too. And he's kind of marveling at it in the same way. And in that way, and the fact that he's, you know, built like I'm built, and, you know, he inspires people to go out and shoot, and not that anybody could ever do what he does, but there's that element that you think you can, you know, and you brought up that sort of thing about how, like, you know, LeBron sort of is awe-inspiring, and Shaq is huge. But it's just, those are traits that no normal, like, mortal human being can ever accomplish. But with Steph, there is that sort of, like, homely, just, like, down-to-earth, like, innocence about him that somehow translates to appealing to, like, the everyman, you know, the every American man or international man, or anybody. Like, anybody can go out, or even the 9-year-old girl, the YouTube sensation who is, like, he's his favorite. He's her favorite player. But at the same time, again, you say, like, there's that blowback from being wholesome. Do you think within the NBA that people resent the fact that the everyman is so attracted to Steph's personality or his plight?
I think some of the blowback is that there are some traits about Steph that people absolutely love, and it may feel like nobody sees them in others, right? So it's like, you like Steph for X, but you've never beloved this player who also has X. So why Steph, right? I think,
Is that part of the LeBron thing too? I mean, like, do you think that LeBron is in a certain way, like, jealous that people haven't recognized him for the fact that he is an amazing husband and father? And
I think LeBron's thing was primarily Steph represented this notion that he was no longer the best. I think that's okay. I think that's most of LeBron. Like he got, but I think when you start talking about, like, for instance, Westbrook has a wife, right? He's a family guy. You don't see Westbrook in the club. He seems to have it together, but his persona is just different, right? I just think they look at that and say, you know, why is it you beloved Steph so much? I don't think they understand the everyman part of it. I don't think they understand that fans recognize that these guys won a genetic lottery, and that's a part of why they're so great. That's what we appreciate about it, is the fact that we can't do it. LeBron is a freak. Like bottom line, he is also extremely skilled and an incredible hard worker, so I don't want to take away from that. But he's also a physical freak that no matter what I do, I can't be that. Even Westbrook, like, to see him, like, on a basketball court, you know you're watching, like, a marvel of the human body, right? Yeah. It's like, how does this dude run and jump? I think Steph has also won a genetic lottery, but not the same type that we're used to. And I think NBA players have been, especially, you know, when athleticism kind of took over the league, they are all raised on this, I'm impressed by athleticism. You know, like, I mean, since you were little, right? It was like the kid who could dunk in the seventh grade was like the star just because he could dunk in the seventh grade. Like, that's what impresses them. It's not so much the guy who, like, is a 90% free throw shooter or, you know, is excellent at keeping his body between the man and the ball, right? Like, none of these fundamentals will make you say, oh, man, that dude is good. It's the Derrick Roses who drops their jaw. So I think the way they view basketball is like that. They're impressed by the physical, like, just awe of it. And part of why, like, Steph has had some resentment is because it just burns them that this dude who doesn't have that is killing them. Like, it hurts more. Like, it literally is embarrassing.
Right.
Even Mark Jackson said this. When LeBron hit, like, dominates you and he gets a triple-double and he wins and he walks out your arena, you tip your cap and say, man, I just lost to one of the best who's ever done it. When Steph does it, it just burns you up.
Well, and it's like, there's
it's like insult to injury.
There's the gimmick aspect of it too that you talk about in the book, that like the 3-point shot has long been kind of considered a gimmick, and you know, maybe not so much for like contemporary players who are his peers, but the ex players, you know, they just don't see that same level of respect about that type of game, about a perimeter game that's so based on weaponizing the 3-point shot, and so they definitely. But I had the questions like so what does Steph need to do at this point? Like how, like what, he's already won two MVPs and a championship, and he shows like the utmost respect to his peers. Like, what does he need to do to actually get it back from them? Is it even possible?
And he just needs to keep doing it. That's all. Like, he needs to show that it's not a fluke. You know, he needs this 5 or 6 years. Look, if the Warriors win 3 titles in 5 years, or if when Steph's done, he's like, a dude you could say, man, he's got 4 MVPs and this number of times. Like, they won't have any choice. I mean, look, there. How long did it take for people to start saying, man, that Tim Duncan is amazing, right?
He still doesn't get the credit he deserves, though.
Yeah, he doesn't get credit.
Exactly, right? He still doesn't. But after a while, now you got people saying he's the greatest power forward ever.
Right.
But there was a time where, like, he just hitting bank shots. He ain't playing on anybody, right? So I just think he need, like, over time, the credibility. That's what LeBron did, right? LeBron has done this. Kobe did this over time, have the situation. That's why Warriors fans who don't watch Game 7, like, or who kind of block that out, you're missing the whole point. Like, this is part of all of it. So when you look at this run, however long Steph's career is, like, that's the L and, you know, the choke job, like, that's a part of the whole story. And I just think his story has to finish. Like, we don't know what the story's going to be yet. So I just feel like that's what Steph knows. This is why this dude is smart. Right. He went and got Durant. Everybody said all this soft stuff. If you could just deal with the initial blow, if this dude walks away with five championships in a 10-year period, what can they say then?
Right.
You know, it's crazy. Like, I was watching the it was a Warriors game on TNT. You know how they had the players only thing, and they put up a graphic that had, like, all the top point guards. It was Steph, Kyrie, Westbrook. I think it was John Wall was up there. It was another one, too. I don't think it was Chris Paul. It might have been Chris Paul. Anyway, the question was, who would you start your franchise with? Like, which point guard would you start your franchise with? All of them. The three at the game, the others in the studio, and then KG and them. Nobody said Steph out of all of them. And it was like, if you look at this thing, only one of them have led their team to a championship.
Right.
It was like, they really are not going to give this dude credit until he forces them to. So right now, that first one was just a fluke. He has to show that it's not. So in his mind, going to get Durant was like, well, let's dominate. Let's do like the Spurs, and let's make this, instead of a 2-year window or a repeat and win 73, let's make it a 10-year window, like with the Spurs, right? And maybe we get four championships in that 10 years, and then they won't be able to deny it.
So are you convinced that the reports are true, that Durant is staying and Iguodala is staying, and that they are going to try to kind of form that new, like, core four or core five or core six, or however you look at it, that the Spurs have sort of enjoyed for the last, 10, 15 years or so?
I feel like if when Andre Iguodala showed up at the Hamptons and he didn't want anybody to know he showed up, because in the initial reports he wasn't there and he wasn't, vocal about it, but he was there. I don't think he's showing up unless there's a plan for him afterwards, because these players aren't dumb, and all of the situations are laid out on the table. Like, Bob Myers is smart, Kirk Lacob, Travis Lank, like, these dudes, they've been plotting Durant for 3 years, so they certainly have it planned out for the next three. So they knew that they were going to be in this exact situation right now. Why would Iguodala go on a trip if he thought, I'm going to go recruit you for 1 year and then I'm going to be X'd out because there's no money? Right. I think Durant has already decided, I'm just going to take the raise, and I think he's even better positioned to do it because the salary cap is going to be even lower. So now the difference between him opting out and re-signing and him just taking the 20% raise is not as big as it was back in the Hamptons.
Right.
Because, like, they didn't do this for 1 year, and he didn't make this move with the potential that he might leave for 1 year. But why was Iguodala there? Sean Livingston wasn't there. So maybe he's like, man, look, I don't know. You're like, hold on. Well, where am I in the plan? I think they planned it out so that those core can stay. And if Durant takes the 20% raise and doesn't require the Warriors get under the cap to sign him, then they could keep them all. It's just a matter of how much luxury tax Joe Legger wants to pay. So that's really the two decisions. Like, does he opt out and get a new deal, and now they got to cut players to get underneath the cap? Or does he take the raise, which is going to be huge, but, maybe not as huge as if he opted out, and now how much tax is Joe Legger willing to pay? If that's like the decision,
Joe's probably all in for whatever, right?
Yeah, he's got to pay it.
He's got to have that team for the San Francisco arena opening.
Like. Absolutely. Absolutely. So maybe they don't get a 4-year deal, right? Maybe they get 2-year and a team option.
Right.
Like, when Iguodala re-ups, because you want to go into San Francisco with a winner, ideally a championship team, and some people to marquee. Right now, once you get in there, you're all right. Like, it's like, all right, now you got to take some of the stuff off the cap. But I think they figured that out already.
And people that think that it's doubtful, it's like, oh, they're not going to, Durant's not going to take a smaller raise than he could. It's like all the superstars or a lot of superstars have done it in the last, 5-6 years. Like the big three in Miami, like, they were taking pay cuts and decreased amounts to make sure that they can fit everybody in there. Dirk Nowitzki, Tim Duncan, like these players have been leaving money on the table to make their team better for a long time. And like these guys like Durant and Iguodala, it's like the exact players that I would assume would be totally cool with that in the end.
You know, I think this is going to be the part we end up appreciating about Steph over the long run. And one of the reasons I really like writing this book is because I like writing about good people, right, doing good things. And I think Steph's example of self-sacrifice makes it hard to do anything selfish on this team.
Yeah, totally.
And I think Durant being around here, like, can you imagine if they lost Iguodala and Livingston, and now you got to replace them with players who might not be ready or as good, and now they're not as vaunted, all because Durant wanted to make a couple million more dollars. After Steph went 4 years as the most underpaid athlete in sports, right? Like, how can you, after Draymond took less than the max and Klay took less than the max, and you never hear about a complaining, after David West and Zaza Pachulia took less than whatever they could have gotten, just like now he becomes the one dude who's about his paper. And not to mention, he makes more money from Nike than he does from the NBA. So Durant ain't hurting for money. So it's like, I think the culture that started with Steph signing that $44 million contract and not saying a peep about it since then, like, it makes it hard for you to complain. Draymond, who probably could have got as much as Tristan Thompson, can't now say, oh, I'm going to get this money, while he's going to make way more than Steph. Like, well, you just can't. Like, it's hard to do it.
And another thing is you talk in the book about Steph Curry, you know, his true love for the game of basketball. And I think that, I mean, it's seemingly from the outside looking in that this team does have a few of those guys that, you know, they, like, that's one of the reasons, one of the stated reasons why KD came to the Warriors is because the way they play is like the kind of embodiment of you know, people who love to play basketball, like the pass, like the, you know, score, defend, like playing together as this group with fun and being able to still have fun with it without everything being so so serious and so much of a job and so much of this duty or a brand. Yeah. And like, it, you know, that's probably worth to somebody like KD and somebody like Iguodala and Steph, it's worth leaving some money in order to be in that position where you're playing with guys who love to play the game of basketball.
Even if it's not like altruistic, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Even at this point, you probably know, look, the way we play is wins. And if I win, I got more access to stuff.
Yeah.
To endorsements and all that. So as long as I'm out in the forefront for the next 4 years, you know, so even if you aren't like that way, there is still a benefit. But I do think they're that way.
And
I
legacy think Kevin Durant. Too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Kevin Durant might be the only guy who could have done this because he's a good dude. And I think he's old, like he's at that age where some of the stuff that might have mattered to him or that matters a lot to other players, like, he's like been there and done that so much. He's like, man, whatever. I've asked him all year. Hey, man, you only had 12 shots. You're like, are you all right? You know, you just check it. You know, for somebody who had unlimited green light, you know, now getting 12 shots and making his money on defense and rebounding and blocking shots. You know, you got to check in. Like, man, you all right? And you know, every time he's like, look, man, it's a whole season. I know over the course of a season, like, I'm going to have 1,700 shots. So it's good. Like, I get it. So he's kind of got a perspective that, man, like, it's hard to walk into this. It sounds good on paper, right? It sounds good. Like, yeah, play team ball. But, man, sometimes you just don't get the rock.
But it's also, but the winning certainly helps, right? Like, you covered this team back when you might have had guys that would be unselfish and were willing to, you know, to give up some shots to get somebody else shots, but not if they're, you know, winning 20 games a season, right?
Like, not if you're giving up shots to scrubs, right?
Well, yeah,
all right, you can get it. I give up some shots to Klay, but I'm not giving it up to DeMarcus Nelson.
Right. Yeah, I think this leadership
winning thing changes everything. No question.
Yeah. The leadership thing is fascinating to me. You in your first chapter, you compared Curry to like Jordan, Kobe, Iverson, and especially with Jordan and Kobe, these are two leaders who were like in your face leaders, like yelling at their teammates and such. And, you know, sometimes Kobe, you know, there's all kinds of reports of Kobe just being a straight jerk to his teammates. Right. And Curry's just kind of different sort of leader. And I've always thought that part of why he doesn't get the respect is because we come to appreciate those type of leaders instead of the Tim Duncan, Steph Curry type leaders who may be quieter, maybe more selfless, maybe more less about themselves. And I think Curry's leadership is something that should be put more in the forefront. We should be talking more about like the way he set the tone for his culture. Like, I think that's fascinating.
I'm with you. And you know, like, I don't know. We have this inability to like, everything feels like it's mutually exclusive. Right. Like, if you're a good leader and we believe you're a good leader in this way, then you can't be a good leader the other way. Like, that's automatically
weak.
I don't know why we're like that. I think both can be done. Both are done. Here's the part that's really interesting to me, and I'm seeing it with Draymond. And you know, a lot of the slight stuff Draymond gets them too. I think people look at Draymond like, man, that dude can't play because he's not physically overpowering. What amazed me was how people prod Steph, and like they don't even have it in their mind. Maybe we shouldn't mess with that dude, right? And some of these other guys, you know, like, all right, let's just play ball, because if I get this dude mad, then he's going to go off on me, and I might get embarrassed. And they just prodded. I'm like, I think they get it now, though. I think they start to understand now. But at the time I was writing, especially, like, you guys really don't understand. Like, this dude is a savage, just like Kobe.
Right.
Like,
right.
you might want to, like, kid, nobody would go up to Kobe talking crazy. And it's like the moment Steph gets mad, you know what he's doing? He's coming down trying to hit you with a cross, and he's going to hit a three on you, and then he's going to shoot me. And then you're going to be mad that he did it. And it's like if you would have just played, then maybe he would have gotten lost in this off the ball, right? And setting screens for people. It was just a trip. Now they do it to Draymond. It's like, when y'all going to stop attacking Draymond? Like, don't you, they look at him like, oh, man, I could take him. But in game, what was it, the last game, game three, Rudy Gobert comes down the middle and it's just Draymond right there, and he's got to run a head start. And he did not try to dunk on Draymond. I was like, there you go.
Starting to see
it. They finally woke up.
You talked about you gave a story.
All right, let me do this.
You gave a story in the book about Jonathan Simmons as a rookie, supposedly, you know, maybe coming in as like the Steph stopper, right? Like he was going to try to cut his teeth on being that defensive guy that could slow Steph down, and so he picked him up, you know, three quarters court and tried to defend him, you know, pressing him all the way down, and to that point, Curry had been like having a good fun time, and then he saw this as a level of disrespect. I'd never really thought about that as like people picking somebody up full court or three quarters court as like a sign of disrespect because you don't think that they're going to get by them. And the same thing with Draymond is like, you know, going one on one in the post, like you just don't think that they can stop you. And like, and Steph just destroyed Jonathan Simmons. And you're right, Draymond just like, he never loses those matchups. He just doesn't lose them.
It's crazy. I mean, I guess they're starting to figure it out now, but like Steph is that dude. You know what the book on Steph was to always, like before it was to trap him and double team him, it was to put a wing on him, right? Remember that? It was like, all right, the point guard was guarding you. Now we're going to get our super athletic 6'6" wing and put you and press up on you. And it was like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? And he just killed. I remember it was like, I think it was like Dante Jones or something.
Yeah,
it was like those types, and he just torched them because they're like, okay, let me just bully him, and he just uses their aggressiveness against them, set them up on the screen. It's amazing how not smart many NBA players are. Let's just like we start talking about like players with high IQ, but the reason they're so smart is because a lot of these players are not that smart. Like they know how to do what they know how to do. But they definitely can't read, like, they're not reading this stuff. And that's how players like Draymond thrive in a league because he knows what you're about to do, and you have no idea what he's about to do. And as long as like people are just not that smart in the league, like that dude is going to be great. They're just not that smart.
I wrote down in my notes that I wanted you to write a book on Draymond Green next, because that's a story right there, huh?
Oh man, I think Draymond Green might want to write his own book. Jeff didn't want a book. I think Draymond is like, hold on, man. I'm still my own writer.
He'd just be like, nah, I'm doing this.
Give me a pen.
Yeah,
absolutely. I would definitely ghostwrite Draymond Green's book. No question. That would be, I just want to hear the stories. Like, I know a lot of stories, but I bet I don't even know the half.
That was a question I had about this story, this book. Do you feel like you had to hold stuff back because you're still so intimately tied to the team?
Not really. The hard part was, number one, I was covering a playoff run. So like that's number one, right? Like I was doing my day job, like what we thought was covering a championship run.
So you wrote it a year ago during that run?
I wrote it. I started writing in January, but then I stopped because I did something stupid. So we got the deal in January, like late January, I think like 23rd or something. And so I started doing research and plotting my plan, and they told me like July 15th was it. So I had to like jump on it. But then my advance check didn't come, and I kept asking the agent, like, yo, where's my check? Where's my check? And it didn't come. So then I felt like, you know, my East Oakland censors popped up, and I was like, man, these dudes are about to hustle me. So I was like, I'm not doing another thing until I get my check. That never did come to like April, like late April. I was like, what the? So I lost like 2 months because I was like, I felt like something was about to happen and they were going to hustle me. So really, I started in like April. And I was, and it was due July 15th. So
you wrote April to July. You wrote the whole book.
April to July, I wrote the whole book. But actually, you know, I got a reprieve because when they lost, I had to like take. We lost like 30,000 words because it was supposed to be Steph Curry, and the championship season. Right, we're gonna go from championship to championship, and it was gonna be chronological. And I'm getting all these behind the scenes stuff, and I'm like chronicling the season and Steph. And so all that season stuff got lopped off. So then, like, after the finals, they was like, all right, we're going to give you to August 15th. We're going to add a month. So I was like, you know what? That's not the worst thing in the world. Let's go. And then they signed Durant. So I never actually got a break where I wasn't doing both at the same time. But to answer your question, it wasn't hard to not put stuff in. It was actually the difficulty was getting stuff to put in because so much of the stuff that I had was just not relevant to the final story. You know what I'm saying? So before there was a lot of stuff in, but then I had to like choose, and it's like, all right, I got to explain. Let's explain how this Steph thing happened. So then it was like, all right, how do I get, what can I get back in here? And then I got to go find more stuff to put in here because I lost so much. And that was the difficult part. I felt like, and you know, here's the difficult, another hard part for me was, you know, how they say you're so far in the forest, you can't see the trees. Right. Like in their mind, this book was for this national audience for the people whom Steph dropped out of the sky in 2014, right? That's who this book was for. So a lot of the stuff that you and I might think is like, why would I put this in a book? Everybody knows this. They're like, no. You need to explain this because everybody doesn't know it. And these are like people in New York. Many of them aren't like Warriors fans. They like been bleeding with the Knicks forever. So I just didn't realize how much stuff people just don't know.
Right.
Right. So I had to like go back and put stuff that I thought was already kind of part of the national story. But then when you realize, you know, there's somebody's grandmother who just saw him on a Brita commercial and now they love him. So they don't know who that is.
So if you could go back just for Warriors fans, or write another one just for what do you think would be different about the book? Like what more of your voice would you put in?
If I just for Warriors fans, I would probably dig more into how Steph kind of just changed this whole fan, like just the whole Warriors experience. is so drastically different.
Yeah.
And not just for like a few people. I'm talking about generations. Like, if I just think like my dad and me, like, right. It's just like getting into that, like what life was like. You know what I was thinking? I wanted to do this and I really didn't have time. I would have loved to just like talk to old coaches about like the point guard lineage of the Warriors. And, you know, like, cause for me, I feel like for the longest time, all we really had was point guards. We had like one little tough, scrappy point guard who, like, you know, who every now and then could do something great, but then overall, like, he wasn't as good as everybody else. But from Sleepy Floyd to Tim Hardaway to Vincent Askew, and you know, I mean, obviously, I'm thinking of Keith, Mr. Jennings, and
like, that's my boy.
That was our lineage. Was like some little point guard out over his head. That's why we don't like Montego Cummings, right? That's why he's like going down. You know how many like bad draft picks with Montego Cummings? You remember him? He's the point guard, and he was supposed to represent, like, at least give us a couple blows. So just that whole lineage of how we've always kind of been enamored by, especially the undersized, you know, don't really belong but can get a couple blows in here and there, and how the whole experience just changed with Steph. And now I would have got into the bandwagon Warrior fan and kind of deciphering that. I just feel like from the Bay, I don't think people – I think this is one of the things that get lost in the Warriors' fatigue and how people – like what people don't really give them credit for is they – like the Warriors sucked for so long. Like people are celebrating LeBron for like reviving Cleveland, right? And he gets all the credit in the world for that. That is an amazing story. But it's the same story with the Warriors, right?
Yeah.
Cleveland
had some good years with like the Elo, Doherty. They had in Price. They had good years. The Warriors just
including
had
the first run
years.
With LeBron.
Right, exactly.
Like we just celebrated We Believe, and that was they're like legends, and they made it to the second round.
Right, exactly.
You know what I'm saying? Marcus, so I think that's part I would have went over.
Yeah, one of the parts of your book that I actually starred that was actually the first passage that really hit me was all the way back on page 22. I'm gonna quote you because I think it's a really interesting little passage. But so you said, and in 20 years, when Curry's story is retold in barbershops and at picnics by old heads who aren't impressed by the latest up and coming stars, his look away will be the point of emphasis. It will be the unbelievable part of the story that will force a 15-year-old to YouTube it for proof. Which, first of all, I'm not sure that YouTube will be the thing and 20 years, or though maybe it will be. It'll be some weird like holographic like other thing. But no, I think it's such an interesting passage because like the old heads now are talking so much, like throwing so much shade at funny to think that like we are going to be the old heads in 20 years and like
we're gonna be like,
yo, you don't even know, like Steph did this and Clay scored 60 and three quarters and blah blah blah, and it's just like, y'all, like, go look at your face plant, you know, whatever.
Right, don't know your history.
get off my lawn.
I mean, y'all remember, like, that's what they say now, right? Like, that's like when they tell the stories of the old players that we don't know about, and like it just doesn't sound believable. It's like, man, whatever. Will
but the thing is, like, what Steph is doing is completely unbelievable. I mean, he's more unbelievable than any of those other players. Like, that's the crazy part to me. And I look forward to being that old dude telling the youngins to get off my lawn. And making them watch clips on.
You're going
to
be that guy. You're going to be that one.
Me and Nate.
I knew a guy who would shoot, not even look at the basket. He would just walk away. And your grandson would be like, man, shut up, granddad. You know what you're talking about. And you're going to say, go look at it on your VR goggles. And they'll see that it was true.
Yeah. I literally read that section and I was like, oh, that's so me. Like that's just so what's gonna happen. And I made a whole note of it and everything. And but on a more personal note, Marcus, it takes a lot to write a book like this, and obviously you've put so much time and energy into it, and again, also thank you so very much for coming on our podcast and taking the time out of an incredibly busy schedule in Utah to to, you know, be a part of what we do here at Golden State of Mind. And again, like our fans.
Hashtag nightlife. Y'all making me miss out on my nightlife.
I know.
You got to, yeah, call us back in a couple hours and report on the nightlife.
We're let's do a Facebook live stream from the club. But I think that one thing that I really took away from the book was just that there's obviously a lot of respect and I would say mutual respect between you and Steph. And I think obviously that the church plays a large part in that, but also I think maybe the work ethic plays a large part in that. And I guess, like, you know, you talk so deeply about Steph's drive to be the best and to sort of excel in his field. And I was just wondering if there was anything in the course of writing this book of sort of getting so deep into Steph Curry's story that kind of like inspired you to get over the hump with this book, or is that too much of like a Hollywood storyline? Or, I mean, how much of his story have you sort of like taken and applied to your own life as much as possible, taking, you know, a 28, 29 year old guy's life and sort of drawing inspiration from it?
Man, he looked at my life and got inspired. Forget that. Nobody looking at Steph. I was just playing. You know, I think
a perfect answer.
That check inspired me to finish the book. That's number one. Like, I thought it was the inspiration.
Steph, keep it real.
You know, the truth is, I'm pretty sure he did not want a book.
Yeah.
Right? I think, I know he didn't want a book. I know he feels like this might add to, you know, like the kind of the storyline that people are saying against him, like, oh, it's another thing that he doesn't deserve and what has he done? And I think it's something like he figures is best for the end of his career. But I do think the reason he was okay with it and, you know, he was open with me about it was because, like, you know, one of the things that I've shown Steph over the years is that, like, reporters do know basketball. Like, I do know what I'm talking about. And right. our relationship kind of got started because while everybody else is asking other questions, I'm, like, spotting things in the game that nobody else really saw. And we kind of vibed on that. You know, like, hey, man, I saw you made that pass. Like, why'd you take that angle? And he's like, you saw that? Yeah, so here's what I was thinking. And he loves breaking down that stuff.
Right.
And talking like inside basketball stuff. So I think he respects my understanding of the game and my work ethic and my fairness, because, you know, I don't burn people. You know, you tell me something, I don't go run it. I don't go print it and get the clicks. I tell you, hey, man, I'm going to write this, and then we go have a conversation if you got a problem. So I do respect that. I respect that he respects that about me, and it wasn't just about, you know, him, so to speak. You know, I think he saw this as, hey, man, like, this is good for you. And so even though I don't want it, I think you should do it because it's good for you and you deserve this. So,
I mean, you didn't really have to clear it with him ahead of time, though, right?
No, but, you know, he could have made it more difficult. You know, he could have not answered my questions or told his sister, don't talk to me. You know, he could have, but he didn't do that. And, you know, that's been done before. But, you know, I when I look back at this book, I appreciate that about him, that he didn't like kind of get in the way of my career moment, right? Like, you know, like, I didn't pay my dues watching him suck every year. I guess the thing that really stands out, like the way I guess I got inspired, is that one of the and you guys know this too, man, like, for so long we've done this in relative anonymity, and now people are like, oh, Marcus, you're great, right? And part of me feels like, man, I'm the same dude, like, when they were 34 and 48. But it's like now the attention is coming, now, like, the credibility is coming. And
I mean, what do you hope this book does for your career? I mean, this is obviously a huge moment for you.
I hope it pays for my daughter's college education and allows me to continue living in the Bay.
That is a conversation that we've actually had on this pod like a few times, because Ivan and I actually both live in New York, which is not a cheap place to live. But I've wanted to move back to the Bay for quite a while, and it's like, I can't afford to move back to the Bay, and I live in New York City. It's like, what? Like, when did that happen? Right. You know, exactly. It's crazy.
In the Bay. You know, I'm hoping, you know, to be honest, I really, like, number one, I do want to mimic Steph, like, just remain the same. right? Mm-hmm. Don't change. I've watched Steph go from, you know, a rookie who nobody really believed in, but Larry Riley, and an injured player who nobody thought was going to make it, to this, and he's been the same guy. Like, he's less accessible, you know, because he's more in demand, but he's still the same guy. Like that hasn't really changed. And so that's what I take from it. Like, no matter what comes, be the same guy, talk to people like I always do. You know, like, I try to talk to everybody. I respond to everybody as best I can. But just be cool with people. Like, don't let it get to my head. But I really hope this book mostly kind of like, I wanted to do two things with this book. I wanted to tell a story of a good person and not a story that's kind of based on drama or something negative or scandal. Like, I wanted that to be my first book with something good. And I also wanted to give, like, Warriors fans, like, a book, like, to legitimize, like, Warriors fans in the Bay. Because really, like, out of all this, there's never been a book about us. Like, there's been little books, but there's never been, like, man, when you're in Wyoming and you want to know about the Warriors, like, what you going to read? You know, so right. I wanted to give us something that's going to mark this time in history, that something that just kind of legitimizes us and puts us on a scale that I feel like we deserve, because people just don't understand, man, the misery of, like, you see the Cubs get all the love because they won, you see the Cavs, and, like, I feel like the Warriors kind of, like, got swept under the rug.
And then immediately went like, to, like, fatigue and hate. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm like, look, man, these fans are legit. And you would go to a Warriors game and it's 18,000, and then they not make the playoffs. And then I'd go to Washington and fall asleep, and Atlanta and fall asleep, and Indiana and fall asleep. And it's like, these were playoff teams, right? These are good teams.
Right.
And the arena was not like Oracle. So that's what I wanted to do. So finally, like, on the level that's, like, you know, I know Brian Windhorst and Dave McMenamin wrote the LeBron book that's getting national pub as New York Times bestseller, and I'm very happy for them. I came up with them. They're great reporters. Like, I appreciate that. But I'm glad that the Warriors are right there with them. You know what I'm saying? Like, so there's a book about LeBron, and there's a book about the Warriors. So Warriors fans can now say, look, man, this is my team. This is my star. And we're legitimate. Like, that's, you know, that's my Oakland, like, chip on the shoulder, nobody respects us kind of bent, right? So I'm like, y'all gonna respect us. I don't care what you talk.
That's awesome. Thanks, Marcus. Yeah, we definitely enjoyed the book. We're gonna have it on our shelves forever, and to kind of put a book in on this period of Warriors history, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Before we sign off, though, I'm just like, before we do that, I think it's so interesting also that you released the book in the middle of the playoff run. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of Warriors attention right now, so it makes sense from a marketing and just business standpoint. But it's like, it's the book is so interesting because it is open-ended because of the fact that you wrote it in the middle of his career, and because of the fact that they are literally in the midst of another championship run, and that, you know, maybe you started it from championship to championship, like you said, and then they fouled that all up by failing 3-1.
We don't talk about the 3-1.
Yeah, so, sorry, that never happened. But you know, it's just, it's very interesting. You know, the book is getting released now, but it will be timeless in the fact that it's more the story of his rise, but that there's so many more stories to be told. And I'm just kind of wondering, like, do you have an idea of what your next move is as far as, like, another book? Like, would it be about Draymond, like we were talking about earlier?
I go to sleep for a week, man. Working like a dog.
Listen, I don't have to, I'm not going to write you a check, so you don't have to answer that question for me.
I don't know what the next move is. Look, I mean, just keep it. I'm keeping it a buck, like 100 with you. Somebody came to me and said, hey, man, there's publishers who want this book. So there's a market for this book, and you're the one to write it. And we're going to pay you. And that's why I wrote the book. So this next book is, I don't know. Are they going to say, all right, now we want to pay you for this book? If that's the case, or am I supposed to come up with this on my own? Like, I kind of don't know, right? And right. I'm pretty sleepy. So I don't even want to figure that out right now. So these dudes are talking about, so let's talk about the next book. And I'm like, dude, if y'all mention another book to me one more time, like while I'm up at 5:30 in the morning talking to some Florida radio station named Mad Dog, like I don't want to talk about the next book. Can I get a nap?
Well, you got a game to report on tomorrow too, so it's gonna be another long day, another long week, and hopefully for us, for all of the fans, it'll be a long stretch into June, finishing this season off. So we should let you go. You've been super generous with your time, Marcus. So thankful for coming on with us. We won't ask for another book anytime soon, but like maybe 6 months from now.
I want another book.
We'll have to talk about it.
Thanks, man. So, let me ask you this. Do I only get to come on when I got a book out? Is that how this works?
I'll kick Bram off this podcast and we'll just bring you on, please.
I was going to say we could have a fourth person. No. How do I have to leave in this scenario?
You've talked your share.
Yeah. No, if anybody had to leave, it would definitely be me.
No, Bram's got to be there because at some point we're going to need that diversion to something spiritual. You know what I'm saying?
Listen, I'm going to edit this and I'm definitely going to go find some YouTube video and just put it in underneath that tangent. It's going to be great. I promise you. I'll send it to you. You'll see. I'm not even lying. It's going to be fantastic.
I need you on the podcast. We got to have that random God type reference to God and break down a scripture in the middle of the song. I'm with you on that.
Well, listen, we wanted to talk about the Utah series. Obviously, we're out of time now, but if you can find any time, we'll bring you back on. We'll talk about current Warriors. Love to talk ball with you, we'll look forward to that in the future.
All right, I'm with it. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
No, thanks, Marcus. Right, you can find Marcus on Twitter at Thompson Scribe, of course, Bay Area News Group. Get the book. It's called Golden, the Miraculous Rise of Steph Curry, Simon & Schuster. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it wherever else. So thanks again, Marcus, and we'll talk to you soon.
Gotcha. Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right.